That's Jimmy Cliff with If I Follow My Mind. It's from his 1976 album, Follow My Mind. How about that? This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. I just need to know whether my guest is there. And we'll get started. Okay. Well, look, we'll start. And if you should call in, we're expecting a very, very important guest, but he may be tied up at the moment. Well, not literally tied up, but he may be tied up with some legal matters, because we wanted to talk about the situation in Flint, Michigan. And what I will do instead is proceed with the second half of our program, and if he calls in, then we will be able to hook up with him. A very, very important development in Flint, as you know. He helped us. Oh, here he is. Okay, great. A federal judge last week approved settlement of a public interest lawsuit that won a significant victory for the people of Flint, Michigan. The judge's decision binds the state and federal governments to replace the city's 18,000 lead-coated and galvanized water service lines within 3 years. Our guest is Kurt Guyatt, an investigative reporter for the ACLU of Michigan. Kurt actually broke the story, you may recall that, also breaking the story right here on Lead Stories. He broke the story of the mass contamination of Flint's water supply system. The lawsuit settlement, he warns, leaves many issues unresolved. Kurt, so great to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, you broke this story and you've been following it every step of the way. Tell us about this settlement that now commits the state and local governments to replacing these lead-coated and galvanized water service lines within 3 years?
Well, the big significance, because the state has been saying that it was their intent to replace these service lines, but there was no guarantee that they were going to keep that commitment. And we filed, along with the Natural Resources Defense Council and Coalition of Flint Residents, filed a lawsuit last year, and it was just settled last week. It was a mediated agreement with the state, but the state tried to have it dismissed, and they essentially lost every step of the way. And so I think that they saw the handwriting on the wall and realized that it would be in the best interest of everybody to greatest settlement. And the importance is that this is now a court order, so it's not a matter of if the state is going to keep its commitment. It has to keep its commitment. And the replacement of these lead and galvanized steel service lines, which is a service line is what goes from the water main to each individual property. And as you said, Flint has an estimated 18,000 lead and galvanized steel. Galvanized steel, and I can't really explain the chemistry of it. I just know that what the experts explained to me is that the galvanized steel acts as sort of like almost like a sponge for lead. And then it, too, gets released when the water is not being properly treated. And that was the problem in Flint when they were approaching the three-year anniversary of when the city, under the control of an appointed emergency manager, in order to save an estimated $5 million over a two-year period, made the decision to begin using the river water. And the river water is much more corrosive than the Lake Huron water that the Detroit regional system had been providing for about 50 years. And along with switching to a much more corrosive water source, they also didn't use mandatory corrosion control chemicals that the law requires that they use. But because they were in such a rush to try to start saving money, the water treatment plant didn't actually have the equipment necessary to apply those chemicals. And so a tremendous amount of damage was done. Certainly the damage done to people in terms of being exposed to the lead that was released into their water because the corrosion control wasn't being used. But also a tremendous amount of damage was done to the infrastructure itself, including the lead service line. So it's been very difficult, very, very difficult to try to bring those lead levels down. The reports are that they have been bringing them down, but they're still not in compliance with the federal regulations. In order to be in compliance, they have to have two consecutive six-month testing periods where they are under the federal action level of 15 parts per billion in the testing of high-risk homes, high-risk home being those that have either lead service lines or lead plumbing in their house. So until that's done, the water is not safe to drink. It doesn't meet federal standards. But then beyond that, as part of this settlement agreement, the city and state are absolutely committed to replacing these service lines. And to show the difference, I was at a public meeting about 6 weeks or so ago, and the person that was in charge of this replacement program said, yes, we have this very ambitious plan to replace these service lines within the next 3 years, but we don't have the money to do it. Now they have the money to do it, and so they can move full speed ahead. And until the water comes into compliance, there's other things that the city and state are committed to doing, which is including continue providing bottled water to people who want it, continue providing filters that attach to faucets and the device, and then the cartridges themselves. They have to make sure that the filters are properly installed and that the replacement cartridges are given out to people. And this is another big one, which is that pregnant women and children under 21 will be able to benefit from a expanded Medicaid program to help people deal with the health issues, and the health issues are significant. And so those are the main aspects of the settlement agreement that was reached last week, which was
That's a bit of progress. However, comes a number of big questions. One being, what is being done about the damage already done by having lead contaminated and heavy metal contaminated water so widely distributed to such a large population? What happens to those people who have now, or they're carrying within their bodies, unacceptably high levels of lead?
Yeah, so this lawsuit, with the exception of the expanded Medicaid that I talk about, this doesn't deal with that. You know, it was pretty focused on the violations of the Clean Water Act. But what is happening, in addition to this lawsuit, there are a number of class action lawsuits and also a number of individual lawsuits to try to deal with other damages. For instance, you talk to people in Flint and they'll tell you how they've gone through two or three water heaters because the pipes were being rusted in the city's infrastructure, it was also just chewing apart hot water heaters and dishwashers and washing machines and just in internal plumbing. Those issues are beyond the scope of our lawsuit, but they are the subject of other lawsuits that are moving forward at this point, or they're at least involved in the legal process. It's taken, as is often the case with these kinds of lawsuits, a long time to get anywhere. And I know that the frustration levels are very, very high among the people in Flint. You know, the third anniversary is coming up, and people still can't drink their water unless it's run through a filter. So those issues are still out there and haven't been addressed.
But even with the filters, I mean, the filters, they're not able to filter out certain things. I mean, it's an ameliorative measure, but it doesn't really cover the full gamut of the threat of contamination that people are living with every day. But let's at least admit and concede that this was a step in the right direction, and you do have a state that wasn't so cooperative finally getting the message that this is a major catastrophe and it has to be taken care of. Where is the money between $97 and $100 million? Where would the money come from? Where did the state finally find some money to undertake this project?
Well, I think part of it is coming from the federal government, but it's, you know, they just have to come up with it, and they agreed to come up with it. So wherever they have to get it, they're going to be getting it. It's now a court order. So it's taxpayers, whether it's you know, federal money that's come to Flint, or it's coming out of the state coffers. It's taxpayers that are paying the cost for this horrible decision to use the river water and not use the mandatory treatment.
The other thing, I mean, I know this is totally outside the scope of the immediate lawsuit and the settlement attendant to it, but there is this matter of public accountability and the accountability of elected officials and the agencies that they run and the offices, of course, that they hold, that refused to respond to this crisis in a timely fashion and therefore could be argued to have aided and abetted by their refusal to deal with the crisis, aided and abetted the crisis. Well, do you suspect that criminal charges will soon flow, like uncontaminated water?
That's been happening. So far, 14 city and state officials, including two former emergency managers, have been charged with felonies. So that's happening. That investigation is ongoing. And you know, it was not just lead that was an issue. There was also the issue of Legionnaire's disease, because they, along with not adding the corrosion control, they really just didn't know what they were doing. They had never had to treat water like this before, and they just didn't know what they were doing. And so one of the consequences of that was that they were not applying the right amounts of chlorine. I remember back in 2015 going around to homes with Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech professor that played such a key role in exposing this problem. And along with like testing for lead, he was also testing for chlorine. And in house after house after house, he wasn't finding chlorine in the water at all. And so you had this situation where the chlorine allowed the Legionnaire's disease, which is a disease that in a lot of ways is very similar. Symptoms are very similar to pneumonia, and it's caused by bacteria. So there's no chlorine being found in the water, which allows the bacteria to survive. And then that bacteria of iron particles are food for it. So it actually was creating a situation where the bacteria could thrive. And there's at least a dozen people who died from Legionnaire's disease. And there was also just recently a very, very good story in Bridge Magazine. It's a nonprofit journalism effort that's going on here in Michigan, where they discovered also that cases of pneumonia really spiked as well. And the suspicion at this point is that a lot of those pneumonia cases were really Legionnaire's disease. And it was just being misdiagnosed as pneumonia, and so there were incredible spike in those, and so that was going on with this as well. So the damage done by this imposition of austerity measures has shown just how short-sighted that approach is in the long run. And it's going to cost, you know, they said they were going to save $5 million over 2 years. I mean, you're already talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that taxpayers are having to come up with. And if these class action lawsuits are successful, it's going to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars more, along with like the things we were talking about with the damage to appliances and things like that. I mean, another thing was that property values, which were already pretty low in Flint. Flint was hit particularly hard by the crash back in 08 because the lenders of these predatory loans targeted minority communities like Detroit and Flint. So, I mean, people just can't sell their houses. And so that's another consequence of this. You know, Flint's economy was badly badly hurt by this as well.
Could you talk about just extend that discussion a bit, because this problem, is there a reason that you think Flint and places like Flint seem to be targeted for these kinds, for this kind of treatment, the assumption being that there will be no fight back? You've been investigating the story. You broke the story. You must have come to some kind of conclusion about why is it that these communities seem to be targeted. Have you thought about that?
Well, actually, the Michigan Civil Rights Commission a month or so ago released the result of its investigation into the issue, and part of it is this, you know, history of structural racism that existed in cities like Flint, where in Detroit, Detroit white people started to move out in the 1950s, and they were able to move out of the city because the interstate highway system was being built, and then the federal government was offering subsidized home mortgages that made it, you know, affordable for people to move to the suburbs, except that they would not give, as a matter of policy, would not give those loans to people of color. And so as the people would leave, then that erodes the tax base, which then causes a reduction in services, which then causes more people to leave. And so it just creates this vicious downward spiral that is very much directly connected to racism. That's part of it. Flint is a majority African-American city. I mean, the other thing is then when General Motors, Flint's the home of General Motors, shut down plants there, that further eroded the tax base. And then also then, Flint used to have 200,000 people. Now it has fewer than 100,000 people. Used to have all these massive auto plants that most of which have shut down. So you have a system that is over capacity. It's able to deliver much, much more water than is currently needed. And what happens is that water in certain areas will sit there for, you know, days and days, sometimes weeks. And when it's sitting there, the chlorine dissipates, which then allows for bacterial contamination. And so part of it is these historic problems. But, you know, when Michigan's emergency manager law, which for your listeners that aren't familiar with it, under Michigan law, financially struggling cities, counties, school districts can be taken over by the state. And what are called emergency managers are appointed, and they are given complete control over the jurisdictions that they're put in charge of. Elected officials, school board members, city council members, they don't have any authority whatsoever. Whatever authority they might have, the emergency manager gives them. But the bottom line is that it's the emergency manager makes the decisions. For instance, in March of 2015, after they'd been on the Flint River for about a year, the Flint City Council voted to return to the Detroit system. The emergency manager said, no, you can't afford it, and besides, the water's perfectly safe. So essentially he was saying, just shut up and drink it. And the people of Flint didn't accept that and kept fighting, and they're still fighting, but the biggest thing was to participate in this independent testing of the water that Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech was involved in, that proved that the lead levels were much higher than what the city and state were claiming.
What do you say about the role of activists and just regular people deciding this is just not going to continue?
You know, the world wouldn't know about what happened in Flint if it wasn't for the activists refusing to believe that, you know, water that was, you know, terribly discolored and tasted bad and smelled bad was as safe as the government was saying it was. They just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. They tried filing a lawsuit of their own initially. That got rejected by the courts, and so they what they did was they banded together. We worked with them. Mark Edwards worked with them and did this unprecedented testing of the water. We tested 277 homes in a 3-week period, about four times as many homes as the city and state tested over a 6-month period to show exactly what was going on, and that's when the high lead levels were first revealed. So the activists, they educated themselves. We have a documentary called Here's to Flint that people can find if they go to the ACLU of Michigan website. And the documentary Here's to Flint, it's about 45 minutes. People can see it. What that documentary records is just the, you know, at one point in April of 2015, one of the moms that was a key to the fight is sitting on her front porch stoop saying exactly what was going on. They had researched the issue. They had brought in an expert, this guy named Bob Bocock, who works on these issues. He came and did an analysis of what was going on, and so the residents knew what was going on. There, you know, Leanne Walters is the name of the woman. She was sitting on her step saying, you know, what's happening is they switched this water source, and now these pipes are eating themselves up from the inside out. And at the same time, that the experts, you know, scientists with doctorate degrees, you know, are trying to tell them that it was safe. And it's just amazing to go back and look at that now and see how they were exactly right in what they were claiming, and how the experts were either wrong, but it's hard to believe that they were that wrong. You know, it's because if you look at water and the water is the color of rust, that means iron is leaching into it. And if iron's leaching into it, then lead's leaching into it. You know, you really don't need to be that much of a scientist to figure that out. But that was what was going on. There was just consistent, adamant denials that the water was anything but unsafe, you know, that it was fine. And so the activist, the resident activist aspect of this is, it's you know, that part of the story gets kind of missed in most of the media coverage, but that was the key to it. Citizen action was the key to uncovering this. I wouldn't have been able to break this story if one of the homeowners didn't leak to me an internal EPA memo that had been given to them, and that was what started to blow the lid off of things. Although the state denied there was a problem even after that, and that's when we all got together and came up with a plan to do our own independent water tests.
Well, this settlement addresses a piece of it, a very important piece of it, not all of it, as we've discussed, there is a matter of holding the public officials and the agencies that they are responsible for, holding them responsible for the catastrophe. There's still the matter of getting people properly diagnosed. I've seen parents concerned about strange behaviors in their children, very young children. They suspect it's linked to the water. The elderly as well, suffering strange maladies that people suspect might be related to the water crisis. And we're talking about the future. Nobody knows what would happen to such people. How are they to be compensated or taken care of, having been systematically poisoned over a period of time? This is a very serious issue. But the one good thing, I think you might agree, is that the lawsuit in many ways set a precedent in that people, just ordinary people, with, of course, the backing of savvy public interest lawyers, can certainly wage their own war against these kinds of injustices.
Yeah, you know, we also have another lawsuit that is ongoing, which is, this one is aimed at the school system. And what essentially is being argued is that these children who were exposed to these elevated levels of lead have been damaged. You know, it causes learning disabilities and behavioral problems, as well as physical issues. And what we are saying is that just as the state is responsible for the damage done to the infrastructure, they're responsible for the damage done to these kids, and that they need to provide all the educational and wraparound services possible in order to mitigate to the fullest extent possible the damage done to these kids, so that they can realize their full potential. And so that is another lawsuit that is ongoing right now.
Well, Kurt, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It was quite a revelation when you broke the story with us on Lead Stories about this incredible catastrophe. But it is great also that you are still on the case. You're still following up. And there's reason for hope that some form of justice will prevail. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for your continued interest in this. You were the first one to recognize the importance of this and give it the attention that it deserved. And so I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. We'll talk again soon. We'll take this short break, and I want to come back and talk about a 60 Minutes story. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, you may or may not have seen it, the actual full-blown story that aired last night on 60 Minutes about the September 16th, 2016 police shooting of 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The program essentially was devoted to the officer involved, a female officer, and her name is Betty Shelby. the program made itself available to her so that she could present or tell her side of the story. But it was a very interesting thing. And we have to start calling media people out on this kind of practice because, you know, this was not just an interesting story. This was a story of a black man who was shot and killed by a white female officer, backed up by other officers, and essentially they went through all kinds. I mean, it was a very sympathetic story. Very sympathetic story. In the sense that it humanized the police officer. And the questions that should be raised now, I think, because this has been going on for some time, but it was just so blatant. You had to remind yourself, if the average person looking or viewing television last night, there is little chance that you come away with a very sober evaluation of the case. Because while the host, was trying to, you know, indicate that he was just doing his job. This was a coup, if you will, you know, to have an exclusive interview with a police officer who is the shooter in such a contentious case that resulted, and it was seen, resulted in the death of this man. Here's what happened, according to the story. The police officer comes upon Crutcher as she's about doing her patrol. He is outside of his vehicle acting very strangely. And she asks initially whether he was in any way connected with this vehicle that was running, still running, with doors open, but it was just there in the middle of the street. And things went downhill from there. Based on the narrative that she provided, he was acting very, very strangely. And then later, he was found on a highway, not a real highway, but a local kind of main road. And she directed him to follow her commands, and her command was for him to stand still. By then, there had been backup officers who arrived on the scene. There was also a helicopter, a two-man helicopter. One of the crew, the two-man crew, was the officer's husband. So this began to get a bit complicated, but in the end, it was, without doubt, for lack of a better term, a disturbed person call, a person acting extremely unusually, very erratically, but clearly this was overwhelmingly the case, right? The officer is dealing with a disturbed person, Officer Betty Shelby. She directs him to stand still, and she and some of the backup officers began to approach Crutcher, and he walks closer to his vehicle, She tells in riveting detail how her mind was changing as things were unfolding. Her mind was changing as she tried to assess what was going on with this young man, Terence Crutcher, and what he was likely to do. They were in the moment, she pretty much said. She was in that moment. And then for some unexplained reason, as he got to the driver's side of his vehicle, she said he moved in a manner that suggested he might have wanted to reach into the vehicle, possibly to retrieve a weapon and use it against her. And then she said that he looked at her in what she called a targeting fashion after she had given him a distinct warning to stop. He did not stop, but instead looked over his shoulder at her, and that is when she fired a single shot that proved to be fatal. She herself called out, "Shots fired." Okay. Now, that's what was relayed to the public last night in riveting detail. And she's crying, overwhelmed with emotion as she recalls the incident. And nonetheless, she did say that he caused his own death by refusing to obey her commands. He created the circumstances for the confrontation and police involvement, and then caused his death, caused her to kill him, because he refused to obey her commands. Now, as far as 60 Minutes was concerned, it was a riveting story. I don't know how it did in the ratings, because these things are very much about ratings. But you could say that the program attracted a great deal of attention, and certainly it got an unusual prize, if you will, and that is the direct testimony or the direct accounting from the police officer, the only one who fired a shot, and the one responsible for the death of Terence Crutcher. And you would recall this touched off quite a bit of reaction in the African-American community. But, you know, if you understand these things, you begin to ask other questions. What were we looking at? What was that? Was that merely an interview? No, it was not merely an interview. It was part, whether 60 Minutes was part of it or not, it was nonetheless a sophisticated part of an effort to begin to humanize this police officer as she faces trial next month on manslaughter charges. She was allowed to look very, very human. She's simply telling things from her heart. She's recounting the story, and in the way, under stringent pre-negotiated controls, these things, that's how they arrange it, she addresses certain things and clearly does not address certain other things. And the role of the host is to facilitate a smooth, seamless program that raises no suspicions at all, and that help to, you know, take a lot of the difficulties away. And I am contending that it should have bothered somebody, if not the host himself. It should have bothered somebody that CBS was actually performing a service, a role that inevitably suited the purpose and was to the advantage of the defendant in the upcoming trial, and not the victim of this police killing. Terrence Crutcher, throughout the entire interview, was a guy who had a drug problem. By the way, that look that he supposedly gave her that so intimidated her, that made her feel that he was going to do something terrible to her. The family explained that that's the way he would look at somebody because he had only one eye. He had a glass eye. And for him to see people clearly, very often he would turn to see who's talking to him. But she, of course, didn't say that. She didn't know that at the time. I'm talking about the role of this so-called report, this interview. I'm talking about this highly choreographed and highly produced segment that was aired last night, the principal aim of which, I contend, was to prepare the officer for trial so that people selected for a jury in this jurisdiction, who obviously would have seen this, many of whom might have seen this production last night. The question is, did this, the airing of this interview, will it have, or did it already have, a prejudicial effect on a possible jury? Does CBS care? A lot of facts, quote unquote, facts were presented, of course, from one side. It's not a trial. And the host of the program didn't make much effort to ask questions to provoke her to address the, quote, other side. The whole thing was about this officer presenting herself in a very humbling, very human, very contrite way, very much affected by this terrible, terrible tragedy that came about as the result of her firing a gun at a citizen. There were no detailed accounts from the other side. This was just about her. So this is how it is done in the media very often, where people are able to influence the outcomes of things, influence the outcome of, say, justice in this case, by preemptively taking charge of the narrative and presenting a narrative that is advantageous to the person who is about to be, or who one assumes is about to be, prosecuted. She didn't look or sound, or she wasn't made to relate her experiences in a manner that suggested that she very possibly might be very, very guilty of a crime, of murder, even. It was hyped. Here is an exclusive. The officer who shot and killed this poor man is speaking, breaking her silence, they said. It's like an old tabloid, except they're talking about a man who is dead. And certainly there is a whole range of questions that any competent lawyer would have asked had such access been given. But CBS tried this case last night. And under the guise of journalism, they certainly made it known that the officer, Officer Shelby, you could say what you want, but she seems to be a nice person, as if that is the issue. She is not being tried, or her crime has nothing to do with whether she's a nice lady. Her crime, the crime for which she is to be tried, is for killing someone. And CBS took, 60 Minutes took very great care to present this case in a proactive way, so as to remove any legal harm, any major legal harm that she might suffer in the course of her trial that's upcoming. This is how it's done. It's right in your face. And they're making it look like journalism. The question therefore comes, and this should be, I think, the cause of legal action against CBS and against 60 Minutes for serving as a kind of proxy to undermine the legal integrity of this case. This, to me, is very serious. It's not journalism. And even if you could say, well, it qualifies as journalism because questions were asked and answered that related to this particular shooting, the fact is, this is a pending legal case. And even if people want to make the argument, look, well, the officer spoke on her own volition, I would bet my bottom dollar that her lawyers probably made CBS sign a whole ream of papers to qualify for exclusive rights to this interview. And one of the things they had to agree upon was not to do anything to damage her legal arguments. I bet you There were certain areas that they agreed not to touch. And then there were areas where they were encouraged to extend themselves and their medium in a sympathetic way to the officer, which is to say, to operate in such a way as to damage the legal defenses of the victim in this case. So we have come to a point where I think a lawsuit is well in order. Is this journalism? Did CBS provide a journalism, a journalistic service here? Or could it be argued that CBS actually was a partner in framing the defense of this officer? That's the question. I'm going to be watching this, and so should we all. This is media literacy. It was very subtle, but it screamed at me because I'm hip to these things. And I found it most unfortunate how they treated this extremely serious killing. And certainly, they ought to be confronted about it. Thanks so much for joining us today on Lead Stories. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You could reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye. Hey, if I follow my mind, I'll never go wrong. I would have sing that song. It wouldn't take so long. Never, never could do wrong. If I follow my mind.